All of us have made decisions over the course of our life. And we've made decisions as children, we made decisions as teenagers, we made decisions as adults. Some of us have been around longer, and so we've made more decisions than others. And so that's the way it goes, right? And as you look back over your life, I'm sure most of us think that there are some decisions that we've made that, well, we would really rather that we hadn't made the decision that we made. We think we made mistakes. Some of us have made mistakes. And that's the way life goes because we're not perfect people. We're sinners and we make mistakes. Tonight, one of the things we want to think about as we go through our study here in Ruth is decision-making and God's will. And one of the things that's characteristic of a true Christian is that you want to please God. And you want God's will in your life. And so we pray and we struggle and we end up getting what we think is God's will for our life. Oftentimes that's pretty subjective. That's usually very subjective as to what we conclude is God's will. We can't go to a book in the Bible and says for John Callahan, this is God's will, do this at age, you know, whatever, and then at age you do this, and at age you do that, and there's not this long list of things I'm supposed to do. There's not a long list for anybody else here either. I mean, that's not the way it works. And so when you're trying to do what you think is God's will, it's very subjective. You pray, you look at circumstances, you try to figure out what God wants to happen in your life, you make the best decisions that you can make, and sometimes we make the wrong decision. And what we discovered last time is that we believe Elimelech made a bad decision. He violated God's will for his life and his wife's life and ultimately for his children. And if you read the first five verses of Ruth chapter 1, what we were told was that there's a certain man in Bethlehem. His name is Elimelech, and he leaves Bethlehem and he goes to Moab. And when you get to verse 5, only five verses into the book of Ruth, already disaster has occurred and Naomi is without her entire family. I mean, that's bad. And the point that we made last time was that he probably shouldn't have gone to Moab. Because if you were to go to Ezra chapter 9, verse 1, you would find out that they weren't supposed to intermarry with the Moabites. And as you look at Scripture, you find out that the Moabites were a problem. They worshipped idols. They worshipped Baal. And Moabites and the Israelites didn't have anything to do with one another. They avoided one another. So here a famine comes, it hits Bethlehem, and what does Elimelech do with his wife? He goes off to Moab where there's food. So why did he do that? Well, it was the best choice that he made, but it was the wrong choice. And disaster ends up hitting the family. He ends up dying. His two sons die. His two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, end up dying. And in the process, they intermarry with the Moabites, which was forbidden if you were to look at Ezra chapter 9, verse 1. Bad decision. They made a mistake. So our study this evening is about a woman who sees the negative, and it's about also another woman who ends up following God. So there's two key women in this study for tonight. Naomi, she's the wife and a mother who is left without her family, and a woman called Ruth. So with that, let's get into our study tonight. And we'll start with verse 6. And verse 6 says this, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food." So what we're told in verse 6 is that Naomi, and the name of the daughters-in-law are Orpah. We find that in verse 4, and the other one's name is Ruth. And so that's the setting. So here's this lady. Her name is Naomi. She has two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. And Naomi hears that there's food back in Bethlehem, in the land that she came from. That is, the famine is over. That is the point. Okay? And so she considers going back to Bethlehem because the food is back, and so obviously the need to be in Moab has now expired, and so the idea of returning is appealing to her, and so that's what she is considering doing. Now, the point we made last time is that sometimes when you are considering what you think to be God's will, maybe you're praying, maybe you're asking God to give you some direction as to what He might want for your life. Sometimes we can actually end up with God giving us an answer to our prayer that's not really in our best interest. Now with that, I'm sure you're thinking already about Romans chapter 8, verse 28. But the point we made last time is that you can be, quote, pursuing God's will. You're asking and you're asking and you're asking and you're asking, and what you can end up with is not really what is in your best interest. Now you might say, well, wow, is that really possible? And the answer is yes. Turn to 1 Samuel. I want to repeat a little bit of what we did last time. 1 Samuel chapter 8. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you recall, this is about the time that Israel asked God for a king. It was actually predicted in the book of Deuteronomy and 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now tells us that the Israelites asked God for a king. Actually, they asked Samuel, is the way it works out. And so then Samuel goes to the Lord, and verse 7 says, "The Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." So God tells Samuel is that they're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me. And so then in verse 10, Samuel goes back. He's gotten God's information. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. And he said, "This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you, and he will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots, and he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and to make his weapons of the war and equipment for his chariots. And he will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants, and he will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best men and your donkeys and use them for his work, and he will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants." And how do you think the people will respond? They won't like it. But they wanted a king. That's what they were asking for, verse 18. "And then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." What does God say? You ask for a king, so I'm going to give you a king, and guess what? It's not in your best interest. And you're going to complain, and I'm going to ignore you. "Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but there shall be a king over us.'" So they were persistent. They wanted a king. And what did God do? We know that what God did is that God gave them a king. We know that. What we saw in our study in Hosea chapter 13 is that God says that wasn't his plan. That wasn't what he really wanted to do. Look at Hosea chapter 13. In Hosea chapter 13, verse 10, God actually talks about this event in 1 Samuel. "Where now is your king that may save you in all your cities and your judges to whom you requested? Give me a king and princes." In other words, it's a question mark. So verse 11, "And I gave you a king in my anger." God says, look, you know, so what I did is I gave you a king. I gave you a king in my anger. And the tense of the Hebrew implies he kept giving them kings. So he gave them one king, and he gave them another king, and he gave them a king, and he just kept giving them kings. And that's the implication of verse 11. And he also then took them away. So God gave them a king, and he takes them away, and he gives them a king, he takes them away, and that's the implication. So why did God say that he gave them a king? God said that he gave them a king in his what? Anger. So, question for you. Do you think it's possible that you could be praying and asking God for something, and you just keep asking the same thing again and again and again and again, and you tell God, this is really what I really want, but oh yeah, but I want your will. Do you think there might come a point where God will say, okay, I'll give you what you want. It's not in your best interest. That's what happened to Israel. So now, let's go back to the verse I talked about earlier. What about Romans 8:28? Go to Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28, and the verse says, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good, to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose." What does the verse tell us? The verse says, everything works together for good to those who what? Who love God, and are called according to His purpose. So the message is that if you are a Christian, I've heard Christians say, oh, you know, I'm a Christian and I know, I trust that everything works out together for good. Yes, that's true. That is a biblical statement. That is a true statement. But we've already seen an example that on an individual situation, it might not be in your best interest what you pray for and get. How am I supposed to understand this? Watch the study tonight. Our study tonight in Ruth will give you the answer to how this all comes together. They shouldn't have been in Moab, and yet you're going to see that all things do work together for good. Watch this. Disaster hit the family when they went to Moab. They shouldn't have been there. They suffered for the decision that they made. But yet, in the big picture, it all will work out for good. It will work out for good in the big picture. But yet, disaster hit because they made the wrong decision, verse 6. So, we're told that Naomi arose, that is, the actual Hebrew means she stood up, with her daughters-in-law, that would be Orpah and Ruth, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited His people in giving them food. In other words, the situation back in Bethlehem was ideal. There's food, and so she wants now to go back. That's where she should have been all along, so now she's going back, verse 7. So she departed from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. Now we're told that she departs. And then we're told that she went. So it's kind of an interesting statement. She departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went. So we're told they departed, and they went. It's almost repetitive kind of a statement. And they're going back to Bethlehem. So they've left Moab. They're on their way. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go and return, each of you, to her mother's house, and may the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And may the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. All the ladies are crying. Three ladies, and they're all weeping. And you know why they're weeping? They're not hurting. They're grieving over the departure from one another. This means that there's a bond. This means that these ladies have bonded together. They love one another. There's companionship. I mean, this is like closeness. I mean, we've all seen it, right? We've all seen this in families. You get some ladies together and somebody's getting ready to leave, and what happens? It's usually the ladies who cry, not the men. On occasion, you might see some men crying, but that's what's going on here. There's this bond, and they're departing, and so you know the ladies are breaking down, and they're just weeping. Wonder how much weeping was going on. But anyway, we're told that they're weeping. Now, what's important to notice in verse 8 is that Naomi is trying to encourage them to return. In two different ways encourages them. The first thing she says is, "May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." Now, what does that first statement tell you about these two daughters-in-law? They're great. These two daughters-in-law are really wonderful individuals. They have a passion for others. They have cared for her. They have cared for their husbands. Speaks of the fact that these are honorable women, and they're caring women, compassionate towards their mother-in-law. It's great commendation for these ladies. Really excellent. And think about it. It comes from the mother-in-law. When's the last time you heard a mother-in-law make a good comment about us, a daughter-in-law? I mean, usually there's this tension between mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law. For mothers-in-law, nobody's good enough for my son. You know, it's kind of like the standard criticism, right? Well, this mother-in-law, Naomi, has really good things to say about her two daughters-in-law. Now, that says something about Naomi. That says something about the three ladies. I mean, these are great ladies. Now, clearly, Naomi's Jewish, and the two daughters-in-law are Moabites. Normally, Moabites and Jews have nothing to do with one another. So this is interesting. Think about it from the standpoint of race relations. That tells you something about the bond. But what is Naomi trying to do? Naomi is trying to encourage them to stay in Moab and not come to Bethlehem. You say, like, why? Well, you're going to find out in a little bit. Verse 9. Verse 9 then gives you the second positive thing that Naomi says about them. "And may the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So what Naomi's doing is actually granting them blessings or giving them blessings. And she's putting it in the form of a may the Lord. She does that twice. And she's trying to encourage these two daughters-in-law to go back and to stay in Moab. Now, what we don't know is how much time has elapsed. What we don't know is how far the ladies already traveled before Naomi says this in verse 8. Because in verse 6, they got up. Then verse 7, they departed. And verse 8, we're told, and she then turns to her two daughters-in-law and then encourages them to go back. Okay? And what we don't know is how much time has elapsed. If you were to look at a map, what you'd find is that Moab is on the east side of the Dead Sea, and then the Jordan River goes straight up, obviously, from the Dead Sea. For these three ladies to go from Moab over to Bethlehem, more than likely would go over the northern part of the Dead Sea and then back on the west side of the Dead Sea, and then get down to Bethlehem. It's a, like, 50 to 70-mile trip, depending upon where they were in Moab. Or a 7 to 10-day trip. That's rough mileage, rough timeline, okay? And so what we don't know is, are they at the border of Moab when Naomi encourages them to stay? I tend to think that's where they were. I tend to think that they haven't probably left Moab yet. I think Naomi's been walking and she's thinking about this, and you're going to see in a little bit, she's struggling with a problem. The problem hasn't been made known to us yet. There's a problem Naomi's struggling with. But along the way, Naomi has been thinking this through, and finally here we're told that she's trying to encourage them to stay. I think they're near the border when she says this. Verse 10, "And they said to her, 'No, but we will surely return with you to your people.'" So the response of the two ladies is that no. It's an emotional response. You're going to see in a little bit, one of them changes their mind. This is an emotional response. This is the first response. It's not the final response. It's an emotional one. "Hey, well, why don't you stay?" And one of them says, "Oh, no, I'll go with you." Verse 11. But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters." Then she gave them three reasons. And the first one is, "Do I have sons in my womb?" She says, "Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands?" So she's saying, "Do I have children in my womb?" And the answer is what? No. That's the implication. We believe that Naomi's about 50 years old at this point. Rough guess. We don't know exactly, but that's our rough guess. So first response is, "Do I have children?" that you can have new husbands? That's the idea. The idea is that, am I going to have new sons and then you get to marry them? And obviously, by the time they would grow up, they would be a lot older, and so it's obviously not a workable situation. But that's Naomi's point, verse 12. Then she says, return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. Now, this is the second reason. She already gave us one reason in verse 11. Verse 2 is the second reason. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. She says, basically, I'm not married. And if I said, I hope, that is to have a husband, and if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons. So now she's talking about, well, how about maybe I have sons in the future? Verse 12, she says, if I said I have hope, if I should even have a son tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they are grown? So she's saying, would you even wait? Then she gives the third reason, is that would you therefore refrain from marrying? Now this is the real issue. And you have to ask the question, why does she say, would you refrain from marrying? Well, think about it for a second. Where are these two ladies going? They're going to Israel. They're going to Bethlehem. And if the Jews and the Moabites have nothing to do with one another, what's the likelihood that someone's going to want to marry them? Pretty small. Really small. And so what she's really saying is that if you go with me to Bethlehem, you're probably never going to get married. Do you want to go with me and not get married? So the alternative is either you're not married or you wait for me to have children, two sons. I'm not pregnant now. I might be pregnant in the future. Is that what you want to look forward to? And she says, no, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. You might actually want to say that that's the fourth reason she gives them, is that God's rejected me. I'm not in God's favor at this point. You really want to be with somebody who is not in God's favor? That's her view. What's her view of herself? It's important to notice what her view of herself is at this point. She views herself as not being in God's favor. And why? She lost all of her family, lost her husband, lost her sons. They made a bad decision. They left Bethlehem. They went to Moab. They should have stayed in Bethlehem. They should have trusted God. God promised He would meet their needs, right? They should have stayed. So they violated a biblical principle, thinking that they were doing the right thing. And so they went, and they ended up in Moab. Sons ended up marrying two Moabite women. And so here Naomi is. She's lost her family. She's got these two ladies, and she sees all these problems, and she feels like she's been rejected by God. If you jump ahead for a minute, and you look at verse 20, you get an idea as to how badly she really feels about herself. Verse 20 says, and she said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. And the word means bitter. M-A-R-A means bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. And I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me, that is her view of herself. What she reveals in verse 13 and verse 20 and 21 is that she does not feel that she is in God's favor anymore. In fact, she has God's rejection. She is rejected by God. She is out. God has rejected her. That's how she feels. So she's bitter. And so when she tells her daughters-in-law, you know, the Lord's hand is against me. I mean, do you really want to go with me? Are you really sure you want to be associated with me? I mean, you can just hear her anguish of heart. And we believe it's all because of a bad decision on their part. You ever been in that situation? You made a decision and Later, you said to yourself, well, that was a bad decision. I'm paying the price. Ever been there? Ever had that happen to you? Everybody's going, yeah. Well, that's where she's at. She's trying to rescue these daughters-in-law. You don't want to be with me. Don't come with me. This is a big mistake on your part. And you left your family. You left everybody. If you go with me, you're not going to be able to get married. The only alternative for you then is to wait for me to have sons. And what's she referring to when she says that? Turn to Deuteronomy 25:5. You see what she's talking about. This is talking about the kinsman redeemer. Deuteronomy 25 verse 5 says, and when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man, and her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. That's what Naomi appears to be thinking about. Then she has a child, then the son that she bears then would be eligible to marry these two ladies. That's what she's thinking about, but wow, how long would they have to wait for this man to grow up to be able to fulfill that obligation? Verse 14, and they lifted up their voices, the two daughters-in-law, probably everybody, they is plural, so it probably includes everybody, and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. What a great contrast. I mean, what did the two ladies do? They did different things. Orpah leaves, is the implication. She goes back. Earlier she said, oh, no, I'll stay with you. I'll be with you. You know, I'll go with you to Bethlehem. And truth is, when Naomi finally lays out the facts the way they are, she says, I'm going back. Going back to my family, going back to my gods, going back to everything. What does Ruth do? Ruth clings to Naomi. I think it's also a picture of Christians when it comes to relationship with God. Ruth is going to potentially be without a husband. I mean, that's the picture that Naomi has painted, right? How would you like it if you're going to Bethlehem and you're a young lady and you're looking at the prospect of never being married again the rest of your life? That was the picture that Naomi lays out. I mean, Ruth has given up something to be with this woman. I don't want to spiritualize the passage, but it's kind of hard not to pick this as a good illustration of Christian and a professing Christian. Someone who claims to be a Christian, not really a Christian. And the real Christian. The real Christian does what? Clings to God, right? In Deuteronomy, we're told that Moses commanded the Israelites to do what? To cling to the Lord their God, right? To cling. We're told to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and to cling. What's Ruth doing? She's clinging. And Orpah, well, that's just too much for me. I mean, I want to get married, so, and I want my people, so I'm going back. I like my comfort zone. I think it's a good illustration of what happens. You know, we claim to know Jesus, but we're doing what? We're hanging on to the world while we're loving Jesus, we say. All through the New Testament, we're warned. Christians are warned. It's not God and the stuff of the world. It's God and God alone is the point. Ruth is a good illustration. Verse 15. And then she said, Naomi's talking. She says, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Get that? Return after your sister-in-law. Naomi tries it one more time. Naomi's almost pushing. I think Naomi feels so bad. It's like, I don't want to bring this on you. Just go back. Just go back. Go back. It's a mistake to be with me. You can just hear her anguish. Verse 16, but Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge, and your people shall be my people, and your God, my God, And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. Now that's called commitment. That's called commitment. That's a good illustration of what our relationship with God should be like. And when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. That is, Naomi, stop, encourage her to return. That's the point. I want to stop and talk about Ruth here for a second. Ruth is really special. What Ruth is going to become is the mother of a king. Who's the king? King David. For those of you who weren't here last time, go to Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4, verse 18 says, "Now these are the generations of Perez, and to Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron Ram, and to Ram Minadab, and to Minadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz." And who was the wife of Boaz? Ruth. Okay, so there's the title Ruth. And to Boaz, Obed, and to Obed was Jesse, and to Jesse, who? David, and who's David? King David. Now, Naomi didn't know this was going to happen. Ruth didn't know this was going to happen. But guess what? Ruth is going to become the great-grandmother of a king. And if you go to Matthew, you find out that Ruth is going to be in the lineage of Messiah Jesus Christ. Watch this. It was a mistake to go to Moab. Disaster hit in Moab. Naomi is bitter. Naomi feels rejected. Naomi has been suffering because of a bad decision to go to Moab. But in the big picture, all things do work together for good because Ruth becomes the mother of a king and the Messiah, Jesus Christ. It's incredible to see all the biblical truths hang together. But there's a warning here for us. There's a warning here that you can push heaven's gate, pounding and pounding and pounding and pounding and asking what you want, and God may just give you what you want. And it may not be in your best interest. And there's also something else I want you to think about. Remember a guy called Moses? Remember Moses was supposed to go to the promised land? That was the original plan, right? Remember Moses went before Pharaoh and he did all these miracles, right? Brought all these plagues on the Egyptians, right? For the purpose of bringing the Israelites out of the land of Egypt, right? And they walked for 40 years in the wilderness, and in the last year, Moses is supposed to now go into the promised land, and what does he do? He blows it. Rather than speaking to the rock, he hits the rock, he is angry, and what does God tell Moses is going to happen to him? He can't go to the promised land. He makes a mistake. And what did God do? Well, I only have one guy. It's only Moses. It's my only choice I've got. So what did God do? God stuck with Moses, right, and let him go into the promised land after all, right? God just forgave him, right? That's obviously not what happened. What did God do? God went to plan B and got somebody else, right? Got Joshua. And so what ended up happening is that Moses blew an opportunity because of his own sin. What's the point I'm trying to make? The point I'm trying to make is that we think that God is forgiving and we think that God has a plan and nothing can mess it up. And what Scripture does in fact teach us is that God on occasions will give us things that aren't in our best interest, and God can use somebody else other than us to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. And yet, what happens? All things do work together for good because even the Israelites still did get into the promised land. It's important to understand when we're dealing with God's will, how God's will operates. God is not stuck on us. God does have a plan, and there is freedom in God's plan for our life. Verse 18, it says, "And when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. And so they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'This is Naomi.'" Now the fact that they arrive in the whole city notices that they're there tells you something about the city. More than likely, it's really a small city. That's what it tells you. Verse 20 and 21 we've already read, and then verse 22 gives us the summary. And it says, "So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth, a Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest." Barley harvest was roughly March or April, so that gives you the rough time of the year that they would have arrived. So that's chapter 1. So what did we learn tonight? Well, I hope that you learned that we need to be careful when we're asking God to do certain things for us. One of the encouragements I would make is to check what the biblical principles are. Biblical principles are a guideline for what God's will is in your life. If you're wanting to do God's will and you're trying to figure out what God's will is for your life, go and check the biblical principles and see if what you want lines up with biblical principles. If it doesn't line up with biblical principles, then stop asking. They shouldn't have gone to Moab. And it's important to make sure that we're not just pushing heaven's door. Heaven might actually let you have what you want. And yes, everything will work out together for good, but you might really suffer along the way. And you might end up being bitter and discouraged and disappointed like Naomi was. So just a warning. But you know what's really cool about this chapter so far? You can see that God used Naomi in a way that Naomi wouldn't have expected. There's a silver lining to this story. We've already talked about Ruth, but think about it from the standpoint of Naomi. How do you think God used Naomi in the life of Ruth? Why do you think that Ruth wants to stay with Naomi? You think that says something about Naomi's life? Do you think that says something about what maybe Naomi shared with Ruth about Jehovah God? Do you think that says something about her character, her conduct, her behavior? This is a good illustration for us. This tells us is that you never know who you are impacting and how God's maybe going to use them. We've often heard the story about Billy Graham, how there was a Sunday school teacher, and she was teaching this class of students, and she was so discouraged, nothing seemed to ever happen. It wasn't until years later on she found out that one of those students in her Sunday school class that she didn't want to teach. She got discouraged. It wasn't until years later on she found out that that young man was Billy Graham. That's incredible. You say, like, wow. Yes, right. Naomi didn't realize that Ruth is going to become the great-grandmother of a king, and Ruth is going to be in the lineage of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. You never know whose life you're going to touch. Ruth chapter 1 is really incredible from the standpoint of God's will. It's really incredible from the standpoint of God's will. You never know how God is using you. It tells us to trust Him in whatever circumstances you find. And we want to change it for something different. And I'm not trying to say that we should never change anything, otherwise then nothing would ever happen. But we have to watch our motivations, why we're doing what we're doing.